like to welcome everyone out today. It is July 27, 2012. This is session 223, Student Political Activism at Brigham Young University, 1965 to 1971. The paper is presented by Gary James Majera. He's the managing director of the Smith Pettit Foundation, Salt Lake City, Utah. On a personal note, which I'm sure Gary's not going to appreciate, I found Gary to be one of the most kind and generous historians and researchers I've ever met. I'm a little partial. Much of my experience in researching and writing of Mormon history, Gary has been there to help me through and make sure I don't make really stupid mistakes, which I'm often doing. My wife reminds me. Gary's publication record is amazing. He's done all the way from Orson Pratt and Brigham Young's controversy, first publishing that in a dialogue article and creating a full-length book. His research into BYU is some of the best ever done. He and Ron Pritis did House of Faith, correct? And Gary is now expanding that work and has published what I think is one of the best articles ever written on Mormondom. It was published in the Utah Historical Quarterly. It was the BYU spy ring under Ernest Wilkinson. That was published a year ago, wasn't it, Gary? Ellen DeCo is the respondent. Ellen has graduated with a degree from sociology from BYU. She is actively involved with BYU Democrats, Student for International Development, Parity, and BYU Gay Straight Alliance, USGA. I'd like to welcome Gary and thank you all for coming.
I appreciate Joe's introduction. The only point I might disagree with him on is his calling me a historian. I've always been uncomfortable with people who refer to me as a historian or as a doctor too. I get that once in a while. The presence of student political activism at Brigham Young University during the late 1960s and early 1970s was, like student activism elsewhere, as much a function of the school's prevailing culture as of activist trends nationally. BYU students across the political spectrum responded to local and national events in ways both informed by and in reaction to political and intellectual currents on the Utah Valley campus. Thus, any discussion of BYU student activism must also examine the political climate at the LDS church-owned school. Such an examination locates BYU activism as occurring at an institution already politicized by an outspoken president, a mostly but not entirely sympathetic board of trustees, and a faculty and student body espousing somewhat broader political interests. The appointment in 1951 of Ernest Wilkinson as BYU president reflected in part LDS fears over the perceived threat of Soviet communism. A convert to the Republican Party and hard-line conservative, Wilkinson needed little encouragement when Stephen L. Richards, a member of the LDS First Presidency, charged at his inauguration that he, quote, implant in youth a deep love of country and a reverential regard for the Constitution of the United States. The church's president, David O. McKay, subsequently prayed that Wilkinson might, quote, understand more than anyone else in education circles the dangers of communism. Quote, this institution, Wilkinson promised, quote, is definitely committed to a philosophy which is the antithesis of that espoused by the communists. Quote, hardly a day went by that we did not hear something about socialism or the like, remembered one of Wilkinson's employees. Quote, he didn't want anything tainting our campus, and he pretty much saw to it that people of that kind were kept out. While anti-communist speakers appeared regularly on campus during Wilkinson's 20 years in office, liberal-leaning lecturers were often excluded. Quote, there are certainly going to be no communists speaking to our students, Wilkinson insisted in 1957. Quote, nor are there going to be any fellow travelers who invoke the Fifth Amendment. Quote, when the conservative position in modern America is viewed in light of the kingdom of God, BYU religion professor Hiram Andrus told students in 1962, quote, its strengths become apparent. Liberalism, like the plan proposed by Satan and his hosts in the war in heaven, is deficient and perverse. The next day, BYU alumnus Reed Benson, Utah coordinator for the ultra-conservative John Birch Society, and oldest son of LDS apostle Ezra Taft Benson, himself an ardent anti-communist, added, quote, we haven't treated communists yet for what they are, murderers. Responding to such rhetoric, some students complained about Wilkinson's, quote, unabashed partisanship. Quote, the political speakers at university programs, with one exception, have been of one political party, wrote one student in 1954. Quote, I believe these programs have degenerated from an educational function into a political harangue. In 1961, when Wilkinson announced that the year's commencement speaker would be Barry Goldwater, conservative Republican senator from Arizona, whom Wilkinson introduced, quote, as essentially one of us, one undergraduate composed a, quote, special glossary of terms. Socialism, quote, any plan for social change or betterment not cleared with either Barry Goldwater or President Wilkinson. Conscience, quote, a special sense of right and wrong which is possessed only by a few Republicans of the extreme right, most of whom the students at Brigham Young University have been privileged to hear speak during the last year. And freedom of assembly, quote, freedom to listen to a defense of President Wilkinson's political philosophy. Throughout the early 1960s, the number of politically partisan speeches sometimes accounted for almost 60% of total offerings. Some students, quote, objected to the use of our devotional as the vehicle of political indoctrination. BYU student newspaper added, quote, most of us who have been around for a while realize that President Wilkinson is a conservative Republican. We know these things because he has told us many times. Another student wrote, quote, can we claim intellectual honesty for ourselves when we present only one side of an issue while the other is disparaged or at best neglected? Not all students were dissatisfied, however. More than a few expressed shock when the director of the American Association of Marriage Counselors claimed that, quote, Soviet families are happier and more stable than American families. One undergraduate commented, quote, it would appear the speaker is in actual essence a socialist at heart and chooses to support his views with what he saw in Russia. Still, many students remained politically neutral. By 1963, political topics occupied much of Wilkinson's time. Running for elected office became increasingly attractive as Wilkinson regularly toured the country in defense of free enterprise. Amid the call for more opinions on campus, Wilkinson announced in May 1963 that Soviet journalist Georgi I. Velikovsky would appear at a university assembly. Wilkinson uncharacteristically explained, quote, we have had so many references to communism this year, it seemed well that students should have the opportunity to hear from a real communist. Two-thirds into his well-attended address, Velikovsky dropped the Russian accent and announced that he was George Veliotis, a California businessman and former history teacher who had adopted the masquerade to dramatize the evils of communism. Dismissing the criticisms that followed, Wilkinson stressed, quote, Brigham Young University stands squarely in denouncing communism as a devilish and satanic gospel. I am surprised that anyone thought otherwise. Wilkinson also expanded the criteria used in faculty hiring and promotion to include, quote, commitments to business history and the business community, as well as, quote, affiliations with the conservative elements of economics. He balked at appointing teachers whose political and economic views differed from his own, and sometimes punished faculty whose views did. BYU's undergraduate course in American history was adjusted in 1968 to include, quote, treatments of the American system of free enterprise, as well as conservative LDS churchman J. Reuben Clark's writings on the U.S. Constitution. After reviewing a survey of student attitudes 2 years later, Wilkinson vowed to do even more, quote, to maintain our republic. Campus dance bands were screened for possible communist sympathizers. School administrators also contacted local radio stations to complain about musicians such as Joan Baez, quote, known to be a communist. When Wilkinson learned that the number of students using federal food stamps had more than doubled, he asked for guidance. BYU's trustees felt that, quote, additional comments would draw attention to the program, but Apostle Benson later publicly condemned the practice. Wilkinson's anti-communism reflected an affinity among a majority of LDS officers, most notably Benson, for right-wing ideologies. At BYU, the response to such a faction was divided. Religion professors Reed Bankhead, Glenn Pearson, and Hiram Andrus favored, like Benson, the conservative political economic teachings of the John Birch Society and had to be cautioned not to, quote, interject their personal opinions and feelings in the classroom. After meeting Birch Society founder Robert Welch, Wilkinson wrote, quote, the John Birch Society is a real patriotic living and moving organization. I would probably agree with 90% of their teachings. BYU political scientist Lewis Midgley took a dimmer view and publicly rebuked Birch devotees in 1964, quote, their morality is simply the old notion that the end justifies the means, any stick to beat the devil. 2 months later, 22 BYU teachers signed an open letter condemning John Stormer's conservative call to arms, none dare call it treason, as a, quote, piece of fanaticism. They explained that their letter was written because Stormer's book was being, quote, distributed in certain BYU religion classes and regarded as authoritative because of his sponsorship. David O. McKay, who worried that Birch LDS inroads were causing, quote, embarrassment, instructed BYU officials not to bring Birch Society speakers to campus. The matter should be dropped entirely. The number of non-Birch Society conservative lecturers picked up considerably following Wilkinson's unsuccessful bid for the U.S. Senate in 1964 and return to campus. As Wilkinson explained, quote, I am looking for the very best speakers in the nation, but they must have honest-to-God American thinking who inspire us to greater heights rather than sow the seeds of disillusionment. To distance himself from criticism, Wilkinson partially delegated responsibility for the selection of speakers in 1965 to a speakers committee, though he retained final approval. Under Wilkinson's eye, committee members adopted a policy of prohibiting speakers who, quote, advocate the overthrow of the government of the United States or of its constituent units by force, or in any other way violate restriction imposed for public safety, or who advocate or espouse ideas inimical to a belief in a divine creator, honesty, morality, and individual responsibility, or take advantage of their forum in any other way to demean the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or its doctrines or policies. During Wilkinson's 1964 absence, BYU's acting president, Earl Crockett, approved the speaking engagements of four alleged communist sympathizers: Louis Untermeyer, a consultant in English poetry to the Library of Congress; Max Lerner, a syndicated newspaper columnist; Stringfellow Barr, a historian and political satirist; and musicologist Alan Lomax. Upon his return, Wilkinson canceled the contracts of Barr and Lomax. When television journalist Howard K. Smith, who had also been invited during Wilkinson's absence, spoke favorably of U.S. President Lyndon Johnson's new society, Wilkinson promised Smith's critics that he would not be invited again. Following the appearance of U.S. Vice President Hubert Horatio Humphrey in October 1966, Wilkinson complained that he had been pressured into allowing Humphrey to speak and was particularly annoyed that there had not been enough time to provide a Republican rebuttal. Less than 2 years later, Wilkinson declined to cancel classes for recently declared U.S. presidential candidate Senator Robert F. Kennedy, whom BYU's Young Democrats and Student Academics Office had invited to speak on campus. Still, an overflow of some 15,000 students packed the George Robert Smith Fieldhouse at noon on March 27, 1968, to hear Kennedy quip, quote, I had a very nice conversation with Dr. Wilkinson, and I promised him that all Democrats would be off the campus by sundown. In 1970, Wilkinson accompanied Barry Goldwater and Utah's Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, Lawrence Burton, to the school's homecoming assembly. Over the protests of student body officers, Wilkinson invited Goldwater, who had not been previously cleared by BYU Speakers Committee, to address the captive audience. During the late 1960s, BYU trustees expanded school policy to prohibit speakers who, quote, engaged in programs or movements antagonistic to the church or its standards. Wilkinson interpreted this to bar atheists, subversives, quote, those having any link with Russia or who would destroy our country, and, quote, those who would defame or ridicule our concept of strict morality. Because conservative speakers remained a dominant presence, complaints persisted. It is my impression, wrote BYU political scientist Ray Hillam, quote, that the Speaker's Committee is entirely responsible for censoring rather than promoting. 5 months later, Wilkinson responded, quote, it is a matter of deciding whether to host speakers whose views on matters parallel our own, as opposed to those whose views we do not respect. Nearly two-thirds of BYU students countered in a 1970 poll that, quote, viewpoints contrary to the church stand should have an opportunity for exposure on campus. Perhaps aware of the sentiment among students, Speakers Committee members tried to increase student participation in choosing speakers in 1969. However, Wilkinson advised the committee, quote, I am not at all sure that students are the ones to select these assembly speakers. Also in keeping with his conservative agenda, Wilkinson pushed for the establishment of an ROTC unit on campus. Trustees had previously rejected such requests, but relented in the wake of deepening U.S. involvement in Korea. Wilkinson assured parents in 1956 that BYU's U.S. Air Force unit had been, quote, set up with prudence under the spirit of our Heavenly Father. He was convinced that such training afforded students, quote, one way in which, in accordance with prophecy, the elders of Zion may help to save our country. Given the alternative facing draft-age students, the response tended to be favorable. Quote, an ROTC unit here now would have certain very definite advantages, one student commented. Quote, male students who feel the warm breath of their local draft boards down the back of their necks would not have to transfer to schools which already have a military program to finish their education. By 1953, enrollment had skyrocketed to 1,800, then plummeted during the early 1960s to less than 100, but by 1965 had more than quadrupled. BYU subsequently obtained permission to establish an Army ROTC unit, and the Daniel H. Wells ROTC building was dedicated in 1969. Following the end of the Vietnam War in the mid-1970s, enrollment in both units again decreased, though participation has remained relatively strong. In many ways, the initial response of BYU students to the Vietnam War differed from their reaction to the first three American wars of the 20th century, where Mormons had previously remained suspicious of the intentions of U.S. leaders at the onset of American mobilization. U.S. Cold War rhetoric had, by the early 1950s, made considerable headway among church members. Nearly 60% of BYU students in one survey believed that war with Russia was, quote, inevitable. Many based their belief on LDS scripture. In a 1952 survey revealed that more than three-fourths of BYU men favored, quote, compulsory military service, but that a majority also felt a person should not be, quote, forced to go to war if he considers it to be morally wrong. Within 15 years, support of military involvement in Vietnam had become a measure of patriotism, and following Congress's passage of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964, 84% of BYU men expressed a willingness to fight. The next month, while a growing number of U.S. college students protested U.S. intervention in Vietnam, 80 BYU students marched through Provost streets to mail a letter containing 6,500 signatures to U.S. President Johnson in support of the war. Quote, in these days of student protests, commented one student, quote, it is good to know that some colleges like BYU are not joining in. As U.S. involvement in Vietnam deepened, LDS officials announced in December 1964, quote, Latter-day Saints are not pacifists, neither are they conscientious objectors. BYU speakers reminded students that, quote, freedom is bought with the red blood of soldiers, not red paint on posters. One undergraduate pinned a draft card to his shirt and announced that he was, quote, protesting against protesters. Fears that a weekly free forum sponsored by BYU student government was turning the school into, quote, another Berkeley, proved unfounded. Proved unfounded when a 1967 poll showed that 80% of students believed the United States, quote, should not pull out of Vietnam. That same year, administrators announced the inauguration of an annual American Week to, quote, promote support for a better America. Military Week followed to demonstrate support for the school's ROTC units. In April 1968, Boyd K. Packer, an Air Force veteran and church leader, publicly condemned conscientious objection. Faced with, quote, jeopardizing its already fragile and restricted arrangement with the U.S. government for deferments from the draft for LDS proselytizing missionaries, the first presidency affirmed its support of the draft in 1969. Wilkinson told graduating seniors in 1970, quote, I trust you will all be good soldiers. One of the most revealing studies of the reaction of BYU students to Vietnam was conducted in 1968 by two BYU psychologists. They found that most students, quote, lacked a solid foundation on which to base their policy preferences, but nonetheless agreed that, quote, communists must be crushed before peaceful solutions can be implemented, and that continued American intervention in the war is justified. A second study added that most students shared a common belief, reinforced by LDS and BYU leaders, in America as, quote, God's chosen land, and viewed American foreign policies as moral. Polls also found that the political orientation of BYU students was becoming more conservative. From 1967 to 1972, the percentage of students identifying as Republican or American independent grew from 54% to 75%, while the number identifying as Democrat rose only from 13% to 16%. Despite BYU's reputation as an oasis of calm during this period, public acts of dissent were not entirely absent from the LDS campus. Indeed, when compared to World War I, World War II, and the Korean War, Vietnam proved to be the most divisive among BYU students. As with student unrest nationally, dissent at BYU embraced not only the war, but also student rights, student participation in campus decision-making, and minority discrimination. Quote, why should the Vietnam government waste its own people when it can succor American boys to blindly fight and die instead? Asked one BYU student. During BYU's 1969 Military Week, a second student wrote, quote, I do not believe it a fit honor to our war dead to display the weapons that killed them. The ongoing discussion of American policies contained in letters to BYU's student newspaper and elsewhere found outlets in more visible forms of dissent. An unexpected voice in support of pacifism came in late 1969 from LDS Apostle Gordon B. Hinckley. Quote, I have felt very keenly the feelings of many of our young men concerning this terrible conflict, he reported at a BYU devotional service. In what some read as a defense of conscientious objection, he confided, quote, a man has to live with his conscience, his principles, his convictions and testimony, and without that, he is as miserable as hell. Excuse me, but I believe it. Utah's Democratic Senator Frank Moss echoed Hinckley's sentiment 6 days later. But at a special Veterans Day devotional service the next week, Hartman Rector Jr., a Navy veteran and member of the church's first Council of the 70, appeared in military uniform to highlight his support of U.S. policy. Quote, this nation represents the last great bastion of freedom and liberty, he asserted. The next year, again only a few days apart, Hinckley reaffirmed his hatred, quote, of war with all its mocking panoply, while Rector speculated that war, quote, was an instrument in the hands of the Lord to further missionary work in Vietnam. Meanwhile, that spring, LDS church members Frank Child, a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, told BYU students, quote, in the name of freedom, we stamp out freedom. And former U.S. presidential candidate George Romney said that the war, quote, was the most tragic foreign policy mistake in our nation's history. As fall semester 1965 began, Wilkinson asked the Dean of Student Life, in what may be the earliest reference to the possibility of Vietnam-related protests, to, quote, look out for, quote, incipient tendencies among students so that, quote, we can nip them in the bud. To students 2 days later, Wilkinson commented, quote, all of us feel very good because we feel that the student body is completely behind us. Despite mounting anti-war sentiment nationally, not until late 1968 did the first significant demonstration occur at BYU, when 60 students wearing black armbands attended a speech by Curtis LeMay, retired U.S. Air Force General and conservative running mate of third-party U.S. presidential candidate George Wallace. Their backs to LeMay, the students tried to disrupt his address by applauding at irregular intervals. Fearing such activities might escalate, administrators produced a list of, quote, suggestions regarding disturbances and appointed a committee on student unrest. They also adopted 2 years later a civil disturbance plan and discussed the feasibility of organizing a campus, quote, riot squad. As U.S. fighting in Vietnam intensified through 1968-69, so did student unrest. In March 1969, representatives of a BYU Free Student Coalition presented 16 demands, including recognition of a Mobilization for Peace Club, abolishment of ROTC class credit, and establishment of a civil rights week to unreceptive administrators. Wilkinson, in an April memo, expressed anxiety that, quote, nothing gets started on this campus against the ROTC, and blamed national demonstrations on, quote, communist revolutionaries. Their ultimate goal, he later explained, was, quote, the destruction of our existing social order. At campus-wide devotional services in late April 1969, Voight Packer admonished critics to study elsewhere. When rumors of a demonstration against the appearance of U.S. Vice President Spiro Agnew surfaced in early May, BYU's Dean of Fine Arts suggested that the university, quote, alert some of our outstanding students to be ready to stand up for what we believe. It would be hard for the media not to recognize such students or to ignore their statements in favor of our position. Wilkinson agreed, but Agnew's appearance took place without incident. Hoping to improve relations with the student body, Wilkinson subjected himself to an interrogation, Wilkinson's terms, by nearly 300 students at a campus free forum in late May 1969. He afterwards confided that, quote, there is more unrest on the campus than there has been in any previous year. As a reminder that BYU would not tolerate violent dissent, Wilkinson had the students' code of student conduct amended that fall to provide for disciplinary action in the event of, quote, obstruction or disruption of teaching, research, administration, disciplinary procedures, or other university activities. Student plans for participation in a nationwide boycott of classes in mid-October 1969 to protest the war were averted when student government officers voted instead to, quote, support the idea that each person should write his congressman expressing his opinions either for or against the Vietnam War. Over the next few years, administrators initiated a program of covert surveillance of the university's radical students. For example, at Wilkinson's insistence, BYU's security maintained a close watch on activist and Vietnam veteran Jerry Owens, a participant in November 1969's moratorium demonstrations, as well as on some 40 other people involved in the weekend demonstrations. BYU's chief of security reported, quote, heretofore, some of our students with radical political views have floundered about rather aimlessly. However, it appears now that they are being used by some rather skillful agitators, some of whom are what we might call known communists. Wilkinson instructed security to continue its surveillance to prevent any entanglement between BYU and possible communist sympathizers, and in early 1970 asked trustees for a supplemental appropriation to cover additional security protection. Increasingly defensive, Wilkinson issued a special statement in March 1970 on campus conduct, quote, any person who participates in or supports illegal or disruptive action designed to subvert the purposes of the university and its sponsoring institution will be subject to immediate arrest and criminal prosecution. Wilkinson also asked the director of public relations to brief him regularly on disturbances or riots at other American universities. That May, Wilkinson applauded BYU's cool reaction to the expansion of the war into Cambodia and the deaths of four demonstrators at Kent State University. To his diary, however, he confessed, quote, there is certainly a spirit of unrest throughout the country, and while it is manifest only slightly at the BYU, it is nevertheless manifested here. When specific instances of student protest occurred on campus, BYU officials tended to act swiftly. For example, undergraduates were told to remove peace signs from their dormitory windows with the curt explanation, quote, you don't need a reason. More drastically, students who publicly questioned BYU policies were sometimes quietly investigated by the Office of Student Life to determine if grounds existed for disciplinary action. After the appearance of one student's letters to the editor of the Daily Universe, BYU complained to the deans of fine arts and student life. Quote, I wish fine arts would see to it that no further letters of this student go into the universe, and I wish student life would see if there is anything we can do with respect to the student. The dean of student life replied that he had been watching the student, quote, very carefully during the entire year. He admitted that he did not, quote, have anything that would justify taking any action against the student at this point, but promised that after the student's graduation, his office intended, quote, to tag the student's records so that he will not return to BYU. In May 1970, when several students asked permission to collect signatures on a petition calling for the withdrawal of federal funding for the war, BYU officials responded by banning all petitions. Wilkinson explained that with the approach of the end of the school year, quote, students need all of their time to adequately prepare for final exams. One student replied, quote, if my memory is correct, a few years ago, a petition circulated at BYU was sent to Washington supporting the war in Vietnam. How can this apparent double standard be rationalized? 5 days later, administrators decided to allow, quote, individual students to circulate petitions on campus which do not violate the fundamental objectives of BYU. Still, quote, all petitions would be submitted to the Dean of Students for approval. Students responded to such measures in part by electing in 1969 and in 1970 Kenneth Karchner and Brian Walton, respectively, as student body presidents. Karchner campaigned on the platform that, quote, the policies of student government are essentially decided by the administration. Seeing himself as an, quote, interloper in student government, Karchner later termed his surprise victory, quote, a cruel satire on student elections that had backfired, and recalled his year in office as, quote, not a particularly satisfying time, but it was endlessly interesting. At one point, Wilkinson suggested that Karchner stage a university-wide demonstration in support of U.S. government policies and BYU's wholesomeness. Karchner thought that the idea was, quote, artificial and contrived. He met with BYU religion teacher and active Democrat Hugh Nibley on how best to show, quote, respect for the president versus my own disgust of the war. Nibley opined that he wouldn't do it. Karchner decided not. Brian Walton believed that administrators, quote, lack wisdom because they don't take into account the maturity, responsibility, and loyalty of the student body, and later vowed with running mate John Ferguson to make student government more relevant. Worried, Wilkinson asked an aide about Walton's politics. Quote, I am told that Brian Walton is very far to the left, he wrote. Walton described himself as, quote, barely to the left of center. In fall 1970, Walton created a President's Commission on Student Affairs with subcommittees on student government, student rights, and legal research. The Student Rights Subcommittee reviewed, quote, inconsistencies or arbitrary application of university policy to the detriment of students. The Legal Research Subcommittee investigated student rights and contractual agreements with the university, specifically student housing contracts. When Wilkinson delivered an address to students toward the end of October, calling for increased sensitivity on racial issues, Walton is delivering this student. He announced the creation of a subcommittee to study the recruiting of black students. BYU religion professor Rodney Turner responded, quote, the Negro issue is a most sensitive one. It should be dealt with by the inspired servants of God. It should not be the subject of a campus-wide forum. Colleague Reed Bankhead urged BYU's returned missionaries to run for office so that it could, quote, be hissed abroad that returned missionaries run the BYU campus, and not intellectuals, disciples of Plato and Rousseau, eggheads, whiz kids, rationalistic sharpies, etc. At about the same time, Wilkinson issued a one-page flyer entitled Men of BYU, A Message from the President, encouraging enrollment in ROTC. 12 students, including Walton and Ferguson, countered with 500 copies of An Important Message to the Men of BYU, identifying alternatives to military service, which they distributed at special Founders Day ceremonies. Wilkinson denounced the flyer, condemned Walton, and invited all BYU veterans to wear their uniforms during an upcoming campus Veterans Day devotional. The controversy reached school trustees, and the Dean of Student Life quickly notified Walton that, quote, authorization to distribute this pamphlet is hereby rescinded. a group of students began circulating a petition for Walton's resignation. They asserted that Walton had encouraged students to, quote, go against the counsel of the church's prophets, and claimed his committees misrepresented, quote, the mutual love and appreciation which characterized the administration, faculty, and students at BYU. Walton responded that, quote, no one should have thought that this year's student body presidency was going to stick its head in the sand. By the end of 1970, 15 students issued a more important message to the men of BYU in defense of military service. Walton served to the end of his term, but his tenure was dampened somewhat by what one professor termed, quote, the shameful harassment of the student body president. Wilkinson's anxieties also spilled over into the management of the Daily Universe. In early 1969, he forwarded three clippings from the Universe to an aide asking, quote, I wish you would take the time to prepare a careful answer to the letter published January 6th, and we will find some way of getting it in the Universe under some student's name. Wilkinson wanted a newspaper that, quote, represented all publics other than just the students. The next year, he hired a professional general manager to oversee the student newspaper. Soon, the list of unsuitable topics included, quote, advocacy of communism, socialism, fascism, and other extremist doctrines or systems of government, of birth control, illicit sex, drug abuse, illegal procedures, invasion of privacy, and other antisocial practices, debate on the validity of church doctrines, ridicule of university and church leaders, and other issues as may be identified by the Board of Trustees. Over the next few years, the list of taboo topics grew, quote, Negro in the priesthood, polygamy, sex education, pornography, nudity, personal stories on church leaders involving age, health, children, etc., confidential church and university information, embarrassing incidents, both historical and current, attacks on church and BYU policies, church policies regarding the war in Vietnam, evolution and claims of science in conflict with beliefs of church leaders, church censorship, and acid rock music, nude painting, etc. At the administration's urging, the Universe's 1969 editor, Pierre Hathaway, agreed to replace the letters to the editor section with a question and answer column, allowing administrators to respond to inquiries rather than have criticisms appear uncontested. However, in February 1970, the paper's manager reported to this Board of Student Publications that Hathaway was guilty of quote, gross irresponsibility, and called for his resignation. 1 week later, Hathaway resigned. Hathaway's critics complained that he had run photographs of long hair and beards, favorable reviews of rock and roll groups, and discussions of the LDS Church and blacks. When Hathaway's replacement in April 1970 printed an article on racial prejudice, Wilkinson wrote to the chair of the publications board, who was also the dean of fine arts, quote, will you please see to it that when there are these articles, they are somewhat buried by their location in the newspaper? In response, the publications chair urged that students be allowed to, quote, continue to publish student opinion and express viewpoints different from official opinion, and that advisors try to balance the same with opposite opinion of equal or superior weight and influence. He believed that if administrators, quote, muzzle every cry of student anguish and never give it a chance to be heard in the Universe, they could expect it to be expressed in some other way, in an underground newspaper, or, heaven forbid, in more violent form. Less than a month later, Wilkinson received a letter from the First Presidency cautioning him, quote, against doing or saying anything which could be misrepresented as an improper suppression of student thoughts and attitudes. Wilkinson proceeded quietly to transform the Universe into a strictly laboratory paper headquartered in BYU's Department of Communications. In referencing underground newspapers, BYU's publications chair may have had in mind two recent publications. The single-issue Cuspidor told of BYU students Dick Decent and Jane Birch, whose conversation included, quote, oh my goodness, is it already time for me to go learn more about the great things our wonderful military-industrial complex is doing to keep that ever-present danger communism from ever entering these great United States? From October 1968 to May 1969, Zion's Opinion, a two-sided single sheet, became one of the most successful independent student publications to surface at BYU. Containing articles and editorials praising a free press, Zion's Opinion also provided readers with excerpts from the school's 1966 reaccreditation report and other information not widely available. Concerned, Wilkinson asked an aide if there were, quote, any legal action that could be taken against the undercover newspaper. The editors discontinued the paper in May 1969 at the urging of a ranking church official in favor of working within the established procedures and organization at the BYU. Other dissenting voices surfaced, but the threat of reprisal limited protest. During the 1968-69 school year, the student club Spectrum, a, quote, forum for open discussion of important matters on a nonpartisan and hopefully intelligent level, sponsored a panel on poverty in America and also gathered 1,800 signatures on a petition calling for an all-volunteer military. In October 1970, Spectrum members staged a series of anti-war skits titled Guerrilla Theater. Complaints followed, and the students were denied permission to restage the production. Spectrum later held a public discussion on Vietnam featuring BYU pacifists Terrell Hunt and Andrew Kimball, grandson of church apostle Spencer Kimball. Quote, if we loved each other, Kimball said, we wouldn't butcher each other. Quote, the opposing panelists and the overwhelming majority of the audience, Hunt recalled, quote, took the position that war is justified under a very broad range of circumstances and has even been characterized as being ordered by God himself. That's pretty stiff competition, but we made our point. The event, quote, turned out not to be nearly so violent an attack as we were afraid of, Wilkinson recorded. Quote, young Andy Kimball is very sincere in his views, but he is naive and impractical. Much of the drive fostering student political activism at BYU waned with Wilkinson's 1971 resignation, the end of the Vietnam War, and an upswing in conservatism among college students nationally. The number of partisan political clubs dwindled until administrators decided to recognize only two, Young Republicans and Young Democrats. Trustees noted that the Republican and Democratic parties enjoy, quote, an established record of not creating the kind of difficulties with which the board is concerned, and banned additional clubs to, quote, avoid excessive politicization. The number of BYU undergraduates favoring a Republican U.S. president rose from 73 to 86%. By the mid-1970s, students had begun referring to BYU as a, quote, hotbed of social rest. While not as dramatic, widespread, or frequent as that taking place at some other American colleges, BYU student political activism during the late 1960s and early 1970s was nonetheless a recurring feature of student life on the LDS campus. Students, and occasionally faculty, pursued a variety of approaches in expressing a wide spectrum of political views on national and local events. Such activism speaks to the intellectual engagement with modern American life that both marks the contemporary college experience and functions as an indicator of the diversity of belief among Utahns and LDS Church members generally. Thanks.
BYU Student Center, located at the heart of the campus and unavoidable for many students, carries the name of President Wilkinson, making his legacy known to past, present, and future generations of BYU students. The legacy of student activism of his time is carried on as well and has been reshaped to fit the needs of new student bodies, as well as new political and social climates. The purpose of my response is to give a brief overview of how student activism today fares at BYU, and how current students have built on the work of student activism during the years of President Wilkinson. Student activism today is alive and well and has been facilitated by social media such as Facebook and YouTube. Even though the vast majority of students at BYU know their way around the internet, it seems that those students with more liberal views and those with a desire to question and discuss secular and Mormon theories have a greater drive to find each other through the internet, organize, and have their voice be heard. Currently, the BYU student groups with some of the biggest weekly attendance are the BYU College Democrats and USGA, the official gay straight alliance of BYU, the unofficial gay straight alliance. It's not official in any way, shape, or form. That's on the recording, so I cannot be. Just like during the years of Wilkinson's presidency, Students and faculty who feel silenced and pushed out of the BYU community join forces to have their voice known and find company of and friendship with kindred spirits. BYU campus student activism often seems to be centered around creating a campus that is more inclusive and where all voices feel safe and heard. It seems that during the years Wilkinson was president, he was the vocal and personal representation of what BYU and its students wanted the campus to be. Today, it seems that the Honor Code, a set of standards students pledge to live by, has replaced the centralization of power of the strong-willed man. For example, on an online forum, Talk College Confidential, forum member Tashalin08 asked, "What made you decide to go to BYU?" To which Flipchick1127 responded, "The Honor Code was definitely a huge plus for me. I love how people at BYU can have fun without going out and getting drunk." On the BYU Online Student Board, the 100-hour board, many BYU attendees refer to the Honor Code as a reason to attend BYU and the culture of the student body upholding these values. While the Honor Code states nothing about which political and social stances are allowed at the university, many students associate Mormon values with subscribing to a conservative ideology and assume that their peers would do the same in order to maintain the harmonious image of BYU. Why would anyone disturb this hotbed of social rest? But like many students during their undergraduate years, BYU students are presented the world they live in as interesting and complex. Previously held assumptions are challenged and situations are evaluated with many gray areas. Perhaps a student's previous conservative stance on healthcare is challenged in a sociology class, or another student understands while being a straight Caucasian male puts him in a position of privilege in an English class focusing on women's literature. The shift in thinking and breaking down of clear barriers was demonstrated in an exchange between several students in the fall of 2011 in the Letters to the Editor section of the Daily Universe. The initial letter that sparked the debate was written by a student who had been watching a popular sitcom, Modern Family, which depicts a gay couple who are parents to a little girl. The two dads are depicted just like any couple parenting their first child, uncertain but willing to pursue whatever it takes to give their child the best, resulting in loving but often humorous situations. After watching several episodes of the show, a student concluded that, quote, "Personally, I can't say I'm opposed to a situation where a gay couple raises a child," close quote. His letter was responded to by other students, yet one in particular could not be ignored. It read, quote, "Just as we wouldn't want a child to grow up with a prostitute for a mother or a serial killer for a father, we shouldn't accept a lesbian, gay, or transgender parent model for young people," close quote. These incredible, hurtful, and ignorant comments prompted a response of a group of BYU students. They handed out 3,000 flyers on BYU campus, not condemning the individual who wrote the hateful letter, but calling on the Daily Universe to stop publishing letters that spread misinformation and promote discrimination of minority groups. The flyer specifically states, quote, "Gay students are in every classroom, every ward, and every apartment complex at BYU, and we want to reach out in love and help you better understand," close quote. Organizing and giving a voice to those who feel they have to hide who they are from a student body that overwhelmingly thinks alike was the goal of this flyering campaign. It was not to change the minds of students about homosexuality, per se, but to create a sense of awareness, community, and inclusiveness for all students. Just like the alternative commencement organized by several BYU students in spring 2007 to counter the administration's decision to invite Dick Cheney to speak at the commencement, much of the student activism was organized around creating a community which respects and recognizes all its members. Those organizing the alternative commencement stated, quote, "BYU Alternative Commencement is a grassroots effort comprised of BYU students, faculty, alumni, and friends determined to make their voices count by marching to an alternative commencement following the official graduation ceremony. We want this event to be an alternative commencement, but also a commencement about alternatives. Instead of responding with criticism and traditional forms of protest, we want to give students, faculty, and community members an opportunity to express dissent in a constructive way." Close quote. The commencement was a huge success, received national coverage, and the administration was faced with a not-so-silenced but peaceful student uprising. New generations of students have passed through BYU for decades, and many of them attend the university to receive a quality education, develop close relationships with faculty, and enjoy a Mormon surrounding. BYU student activism has a long history that is rooted in a combination of a reaction against the overwhelming homogeneity of the campus, fueled by a desire to combine the excitement of having one's mind opened and to reach out to those who have not enjoyed a privileged status in society. The student activism groups I have been part of at BYU have given me an extraordinary community and friendships that will last a lifetime. I believe that the continued presence of students willing to organize and not be silent will not only benefit the BYU community, but the church in general. Students involved with activism at BYU encourage students not to focus on the parts of the honor code that read about the evils of homosexual behavior or about the length of a woman's skirt, but to push the sections of the honor code to the forefront that demand respect for those who think and act differently, and to reach out to everyone in love and in the spirit of Jesus Christ.
I'd like to thank both Ellen and Gary. We have 8 minutes for questions. I'm going to ask Gary if he wouldn't mind just coming up here to the podium so you can do that.
Sure.
Yes.
I just want to feel what seemed to me to be a gaping hole in your story about the Young Democrats. My name's Nancy Cater, and my husband Omar and I were...
Can you move a little closer so
we can go speak in the...
Yes, come right up here.
Well, I'm interested in hearing what Gary says. I want to be in the next book, I guess. So my name's Nancy Cater. Omar and I were married in 67. He was immediately drafted and was gone from 67 to 68. But when he came back to finish at BYU, he immediately took over the Young Democrats, which I know many of you remember. It was a small group up till then. And his trick was that you couldn't publish, obviously, a newspaper on campus, but you could have a newsletter among your club if you were a folk dancer or whatever. So Omar started the Young Democrat newspaper, which each particular issue had something by Hugh Nibley. And it was very hard for the administration to counter that. And that's where Nibley published some of his earliest anti-war things that he wrote. I well remember Nibley coming to our little apartment with his... He used to wear clip-on sunglasses. He didn't have clip-ons. He'd wear a pair of sunglasses over his regular glasses to give us the draft of his latest anti-war pro-Democrat writings. And Omar did face... being suspended from school, mostly by Elliot Cameron, time after time. He was part of trying to defend Andy Kimball when they tried to kick him out of school and was part of all the things you mentioned. And we had also that big event on what later became Kent State Day in May of 1970. That if you guys were there, we had a huge sort of party demonstration at Pioneer Park and dancing and singing all day long, and speakers, and we wore black armbands. More than one time we used to go door to door through town, and I certainly did it myself, pregnant with my first child and an armband. And when you'd knock on a door in Provo, you know, people would just stare at you. They had no idea what that even entailed. But anyway, I just want to make sure we get included in your next version. Thanks.
I'm a graduate. I'm class of 80 and 82.
Okay.
So I started in 73.
Okay, this is the period prior to your...
Yeah. Ron?
So I was surprised to hear the reference to invasion of privacy. I think it was part of the list of things that couldn't be covered in the newspaper. Is that right? So do you have a guess as to if they meant... examples of that by the university, or did they mean was this a good thing or a bad thing? Or what, it seemed like an odd...
You know, I hadn't really thought about that until you raised it. This was a question about the reference to invasion of privacy being taboo. Is that right? And for the universe to do? I would assume that it had reference specifically to university-related materials and that documents or decisions or things like that, that they would have viewed as private, they would not have wanted to make public. Specifically, for example, the 1966 reaccreditation report, they held on to that. They didn't want that released to the public. And that's why the Zion's opinion, when they started publishing excerpts from that, that was one of the reasons why they got in a little bit of trouble.
I just find it ironic that Wilkinson and the others wanted to instill reverence in the Constitution among the students as one of their goals, but at the same time they denigrate the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution.
Yeah, Wilkinson's a real interesting person. He's very complex. There are times when you think you understand what he's doing, and then he'll do something else that kind of turns that on its head. Joe mentioned the spiring, the 1966 student spiring. Wilkinson appointed a three-person committee of vice presidents to investigate that, and that's if he had retained control over the investigation of that, things would have turned out differently. But he didn't. He turned it over to these three men who subsequently... The final report was critical of Wilkinson. So he does interesting things.
He wasn't active in the church, was he?
Well, he had his own definition of activity in the church. So he would. So if he spent Sundays working on BYU stuff,
ever went to church?
I think that he once in a while would go to church. Yeah. Joe?
Because of your writings, we know there was conflict between Wilkinson and Midgley and Davis and those guys. How was this relationship though with like Hiram Anderson and was it Bradshaw?
There was Bankhead.
Bankhead. How was the relationship with those?
I haven't come across anything that would shed any light on exactly how he interacted. My guess is that he interacted with certain at an administrative level and not so much on a faculty level. So I think he would have been supportive of certain faculty members, but I haven't come across a lot of interactions with him at that level. Yeah. So sometimes with Midgley, for example, Midgley interacted with him because Midgley introduced himself to Wilkinson, and Midgley was very confronted with Wilkinson.
Right.
So.
Right. Uh-huh. I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Am I remembering correctly that Dallin Oaks followed Wilkinson
yes.
as president of
uh-huh.
BYU?
Yeah.
My other question is, what is your perception from president to president, which makes it way too broad a question, what is your perception of what has happened since Wilkinson, beginning with Dallin Oaks, and has it gone back and forth in terms of countenancing alternative views of the universe?
That's a good question. My own interests tend to focus on Wilkinson's years and Oaks's years, and so there was quite a difference when Dallin Oaks came on board. He was much younger. He came from the University of Chicago. I don't really know. Like recently, Ellen, when were you? What are your BYU years?
2007 to 2011. So 7/11.
So you had who was the president?
Bateman and Cecil Samuelson.
And so, what do you notice in terms of differences between them?
There's not. Well, Bateman was more forceful. I feel he was only. I was only under him for a year. I feel like Cecil Samuelson was a lot more. He's more like hands off in a way is my thing. It's more, it's the administration, like the more like I said in my paper, it's more a decentralization of power, especially with President Samuelson, where he's very hands off. He wants to just promote, you know, everyone get along. Though, I mean, with the student commencement, he was very defensive about that. There was an incident where he was interviewed and a student asked a question and he just kind of cut him off. So I feel like that's that kind of underlying spirit of we don't want to rock the boat at BYU is still alive and well, but in a not so forceful way. With Samuelson, is my impression.
Do you think that it's the election that is allowing the gay club on campus and the alternative newspaper and all the things we're seeing?
Yeah.
And so you think maybe that will be closed down next year?
Well, I don't think it'll be. It's actually a huge speculation going on right now. But I don't think it'll be closed down. The thing that we are really surprised about is that the honor code hasn't really intervened as much as we were expecting it to intervene. I think the election, yeah, is a huge part of it, but we've also received so much national coverage. We have the YouTube video, the It Gets Better video, if you've seen it. I don't think they will be shut down, but we are definitely closely monitored. But I feel PR is definitely on the forefront with the student newspaper and USGA.
I have a question for you, Gary. You wrote a paper a couple of years ago, several years ago, on BYU and Wilkinson. In your research of Ernest Wilkinson, have you ever been able to identify in his background an element that's provoked his ultra-conservatism, such as a mentor, or a parent, or a life event?
I haven't. He described his evolution from Democrat to Republican as gradual. He said it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's policies that caused him to change. So now his father was liberal to socialist, and who knows? I don't know that I want to venture into the dynamics of family stuff, but. He always said that it was Roosevelt's policies that caused it to change.
I'd like to thank all of you for the wonderful questions and answers, and also again a big thank you to both Gary and Alan.